the Education Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. This is Wednesday, February 5th, 2003, and we're here today to do public hearings on two boards, the State Board of Pharmacy and the Oregon State Veterinary Medical Examining Board. We'll open a public hearing, first of all, on House Bill 5026, which is the State Board of Pharmacy budget, and House Bill 5044, which is a fee bill from the State Board of Pharmacy. That public hearing is now open. Cindy, could you recap the Legislative Fiscal Office summary?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, in front of you, attached, you'll see my LFO analysis of the Board of Pharmacy. The board's revenue is 100% of other funds collected from fees, and the governor's budget is a 10% increase over the 2001-03 legislatively approved budget. There were no budget notes, no audit reports in the last 2 years, no interim reports or studies were completed within the last 2 years, and there is a fee adjustment. In November 2001, the emergency board approved an expenditure increase of 243,000 other funds for a computer and information management system upgrade, with the understanding that the Board of Pharmacy would increase the fees through the administrative rule authority to provide revenue for the additional costs. The new fee structure was adopted by the board. The administrative rule must be ratified by the 2003 Legislative Assembly. Also in front of you, there is a letter from the Board of Pharmacy attached Gary Schubel and Karen McLean. There is also complaint information in the format that was requested by, I believe, Senator Meserle, and information on the PICS roll-up system, as well as the Board of Pharmacy presentation by the BAM analyst.
Okay, and I will trust that during the agency presentation we'll get step through all of this information so that it'll make sense to us. Okay. The Mr. Schnabel, can you come forward and begin the agency's presentation? And anyone that you want to bring with you is very welcome to come forward also.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I'm Gary Schnabel. I am Executive Director for the Board of Pharmacy. With me on my left is Karen McLean, who is Administrative Director for the Board. And we have two board members who came with us today who drove a long way this morning before the sun came up to get here. Mike Patrick is the manager of Safeway Pharmacy in Redmond, and Catherine Liu works at Peace Health Home Infusion Pharmacy in Eugene.
Welcome, and we will be very careful to give you adequate time to come forward and talk to us. It's important to us when people come from great distances to be part of the process.
And my plan, it's with the approval of the chair, is to, according to our format request, take 10 or 15 minutes to sort of go through quickly the materials that you have in front of you. It hasn't been there long enough for you to have read, I'm sure, but you'll have it to refer to. I will talk mostly about the agency and the way we operate, and Karen McLean will talk to you then about our the budget summary and the packages that we're asking for. We'll try and do that quickly, and then you can ask questions and focus on the things you want to focus on.
That sounds like a great plan of attack.
The board members didn't plan on being here as part of this presentation, but they're available to answer any questions that you might have. This presentation does follow the requested format, and I will sort of go through this briefly. First, I would refer you to page 26, which is the list of appendices, and I'll I'll refer to that occasionally because some of the things that you want to see and wanted to see are in the appendices. And particularly Appendix I is the report on Senate Bill 786. I know at least one member of the committee will be interested to see that. And probably all of you will be interested to see what we were able to do. We didn't get where we wanted to be, but we got a good start, and I think we're on the road. Starting at the beginning with the board's mission and the purpose of the board, I mean, similar to the other health regulatory agencies, you know, our mission is identified in the agency's strategic plan. The purpose of the board is identified in the statute, and on page 2, all of that is written right there. Also in the statute, I think, which makes more sense and describes the purpose with more sensitivity, is the middle of the page portion where I have in italics, the practice of pharmacy in the state of Oregon is declared a professional practice affecting the public health, safety, and welfare, and is subject to regulation and control in the public interest, and it is further declared to be a matter of public interest and concern that the practice of pharmacy receive the confidence of the public and that only qualified persons be permitted to engage in the practice of pharmacy in the state of Oregon. That's really why we're here. And all of the activities and all of the budget request to support our activities revolves around that that purpose. I'm sure you will be interested in the performance measures, and I will just briefly point those out, and you'll want to come back to look at them. Appendix B lists our links to Oregon benchmarks. Those are the goals and it's page 29. The material that we worked with the Oregon Progress Board to be consistent with the way other agencies are developing their goals and
I can't
objectives.
Find the page 29 that you're talking
appendix,
about.
Appendix B.
In
the presentation.
Yeah, the presentation.
Oh, okay, we have our big notebooks.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm not referring to the big binder at all right now. I'm going through the piece that's...
We thought you were. Okay.
Yeah, sorry.
Good morning. Did I miss anything?
And that's page, what again?
29.
Page 29.
Following.
That's the appendix that has the actual forms we put together. Following the format for this presentation, page 4 is the beginning of the discussion of page 3.
Oh, I see how you've done this. The appendix, just the cover sheet has a number on it.
And then what font?
So then...
Mm-hmm.
Bear with us here.
No hurry. So, the board's strategic plan identifies strategic initiatives that are listed on page 7. These can give you an idea of the important issues that the board looks at daily, the staff looks at daily, and sort of drives us. The business plan identifies long-term goals, also at the bottom of page 7. And the long-term goals, I will mention, all practicing pharmacists are competent, drugs remain in legitimate distribution channels and are not diverted, all pharmacies are inspected annually, agency has adequate staff and resources, and systems are in place to facilitate electronic technology, electronic prescribing, and electronic record keeping.
Can you talk to us about what an inspection entails?
Our compliance staff does routine inspections. The statute says we will do regular inspections. That's the word the statute uses. And we try to do those annually. We used to do them annually, but staffing being what it is, we don't get to most places but every 2 years or every 3 years. The routine inspection is when one of our investigators goes into the pharmacy and works with the pharmacist to go through a checklist of requirements, legal requirements.
What things are they looking for?
They look for record keeping. They look for how the prescriptions are filed, what information, if all the required information is on the prescriptions. Look at the inventory to make sure it's in date. There's a whole list of requirements that they go through. If you're interested, I could get you a copy of the self-inspection form that we send out. Every year, at the beginning of the year, we send out a self-inspection form to every pharmacy, and then they have a period of time to go through that and see what the board believes is important, which changes from time to time because we emphasize different things in some years depending on what's happened that year.
So everyone, all the pharmacies send back the self-inspection form, and then you have some kind of rotating program mm-hmm. where you get in and actually physically inspect?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, that's correct. Well, they don't send them back. They get the form, they complete the form over a period of time. We hope that when we ask them to review the form with the rest of the staff, it's an informational tool as much as it is an investigation tool, and they keep it in the pharmacy. So when the inspector goes through the rotation and gets to the pharmacy, they pull that out of the book and then they go through it.
Oh, I see.
And what that does is give the pharmacy a chance to come into compliance with any of those particular things that they may not have been in compliance with before. So we don't walk in and catch them. You know, we give them that, and they can catch themselves and then get into compliance before we get there. We still catch some things. But the way we do it is not intended to catch things. You know, we're trying to get them to get there voluntarily.
So get them into compliance, and then after you've given them that opportunity, if they're still out of compliance, you deal with that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, at that point, if we do catch them, we issue what we refer to as a warning notice. We write it up and hand it to them, and then they have 30 days to send a written response back to the board that, yeah, they've fixed this and what they did to fix it. That's not a formal disciplinary action. That's just the interaction with the board to get them into compliance.
Voluntary compliance is the phrase that we use. Representative Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, Madam Chair, I think the key part of this discussion is what we're having right now. The problems we face with pharmacists and physicians is a lack of communication between pharmacists and physicians, and then with the other problem you guys face is an overwhelming workload that leads to errors in prescriptions being filled with the wrong drugs, wrong dosages being filled. What can you actually do, one of the extra, to really address those? Those are the real key problems for pharmacists and physicians, is my handwriting, their reading of my handwriting, and the errors that occur between us, and then the errors that occur between them and the patient when they're trying to fill 150 scripts a day. In the old days, if you filled 50 scripts a day, you were pretty busy. I know it's way past that now. You have to use text to get the job done. The pressure is intense to produce those prescriptions being filled properly. What do you do? How do you check that? I mean, how can you possibly find out if the wrong drug was actually given out to the patient, other than the patient telling you?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, that's the most common complaint that we get in our compliance staff is that the patient got the wrong drug, and they do call and tell us that sometimes. If they don't call and tell us, we don't know. We have taken some steps. And you know, the board is very aware and very concerned about, you know, the pressure and the workload and the errors that occur. And legibility and handwriting is one of the issues. And I think, as in one of our long-term goals, technology is going to be helpful as more and more clinics and physicians get the technology to electronically transmit that prescription to the pharmacy's fax machine or to the pharmacy's computer. Just by the mouse click, by the list of drugs on the screen, they can make that prescription. You don't have to handwrite anything anymore. So what the pharmacy receives is actually printed material that's legible. Another thing that we did that addresses the issue of the interface between the patient and the pharmacist is adopted a rule several years ago that required the pharmacy to include physical description of the contents mm-hmm. of the inside. So the technician who filled that and gives it to the pharmacist can check it. The pharmacist can check it so that the pill inside is yellow oblong pill with the number 123 on it. Mm-hmm. The outside of the container, put there by the computer, knows that that pill is yellow oblong tablet with 123. If that doesn't match, then that's wrong, and they have to go back and figure out what to do. Then the patient at home can also check, or when they pick it up, they can also check. That has reduced errors.
Follow-up?
Yes, Madam Chair. Has there been any attempt to audit patients by contacting patients and comparing what they have against what they were prescribed?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, we haven't done anything like that.
Madam Chair, follow-up? Do you keep records of what you think the error rate is and whether it's going up or down?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, we don't have data on that. The records we keep are based on the complaints that we get on the investigations we do, so we don't really have a handle on what really happens out there. What we have a handle on is what we're told about.
Last question, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. Do you consider legislation requiring physicians not to handwrite prescriptions and that we go to a computerized system or a printed system?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, we've thought about it, we've talked about it, we've considered it, we've considered the reality that something like that would have a difficult time getting through. We have had some conversations with representatives from the OMA. Washington State did some legislation that doesn't have teeth to it, but at least it raised the sensitivity and talks about legibility of prescriptions. If we had a way to get some momentum going that direction, I'd love to do it. It's going there. Technology will take us there, but it's going to be a ways out. It's slow. If there's a way to do that.
But there are doctors in the state that do transmit information electronically right now to pharmacies. What percentage of doctors and pharmacies are in that part of the process?
Madam Chair, it's a very small number right now. I mean, it's been in the pipeline for 4 or 5 years, and vendors have been demonstrating their material, but it's really slow to catch on. There's an expense to it, and it's physicians, anybody, pharmacists are nervous about that change.
Well, I'm looking at the information that you gave us on the complaints that you received, and dispensing errors are like 3 times as many errors as the other things that you have listed there. So do you track them by who's making the errors and what kind of errors they are, and then loop back and figure out what to do?
Yes, Madam Chair, we do. Every time we present a case, the inspector goes back through the file of the individual to see if there have been other events in that person's file. So every time we finish an investigation and present a case to the board, we also present the history of the individual involved. And there have been times when a person or a particular drug outlet sort of popped on our radar screen because we had a bunch of errors, 2 or 3 or 4 errors in a row. And we were able to discover some problems make the changes. And one perfect example was a chain store pharmacy in southeast Portland that had a number of errors. And when we went down and talked to them, it turned out that they were undergoing a remodel in their own pharmacy, and a neighborhood pharmacy not far away had closed up, and that store had assumed all of their files. And so they were busy and going through a remodel and had new staff, and that's what was causing all that. And so we went down there and worked with them to get the remodel finished and to deal with the workload.
Well, we've taken you far afield of your presentation, so...
Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Messerly.
This is just having too much fun. I can't let it go. I'm interested in the errors. If you have any way of tracking errors that are detected that the doctor made. And I've had an unfortunate experience with that. But, is that a problem? Or is there a mandate or is there a responsibility of the pharmacist? If it's pretty obvious that there's a miss.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Messerly, there's quite a bit of activity around that, too. The pharmacist often will report to us. Oftentimes we find it, even without the pharmacist reporting, if an error is reported and we investigate it and discover that it was illegible or the doctor wrote for the wrong thing. We don't have authority over the practice of physicians, so when we get something like that, we talk with the medical board and they follow it up. But we have had meetings with the Oregon Medical Association and members of our board to deal with communication between the prescriber and the dispenser and to work on facilitating, improving that relationship, because that really is important, and there are issues between the pharmacist and the physician.
I have another question, Madam Chair. Also on diversion and impaired complaints, and I'm trying to correlate, I assume that would relate to the referrals and how you, the formal disciplinary actions taken. Is that the category that would speak to complaints made because of alcohol or drug abuse by the pharmacist himself?
Madam Chair, Senator Messerly, yes, that's exactly what those are.
And I see in the referrals that is increasing. Is there a story there or a pattern that you're concerned about?
Madam Chair, Senator Messerly, yes, this, and it's a simple correlation. 2 years ago, we were authorized to have one half of an FTE to hire a director for the program director, and that person is doing outreach and keeping records and working with all those individuals. And one of the statistics we're tracking, but that didn't end up in our forms, which we think is measuring the success of that program, is how many of the clients in that program self-referred compared to how many clients in that program were captured or, you know, busted and sent there by the Board of Pharmacy as a referral. The program is designed for practitioners or pharmacists to go and get help without fear of punishment by the board. And so I think the more voluntary referrals they have is a good measure of their success.
Madam Chair, if I could have one more. Under the complaints by type, the others is a very large number. I'm curious as to maybe what some of those are, but maybe the bottom line is, did any of those others result in action by the board?
Madam Chair, Senator Messerly, there are somewhat over 30 categories of complaints that we get, and the ones you see here are the most important ones. I don't know. There have been disciplinary actions on the use of support personnel, which is the last one you see in this line. You know, there are another 20-odd categories that I can't think of what they are offhand. But these are the important ones here. These are most of them. But there can occasionally be a disciplinary action on one of the minor ones. The use of support personnel refers to the pharmacy technicians and how the pharmacist relates to that technician, or whether the ratio of pharmacist to technicians, or the technician being allowed to do something they're not allowed to do, or the technician wasn't registered according to the statute.
Just one more, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Then I'm done for now.
Good.
I see in the past year there was no revocations of license or suspensions. what can I take from that? That there's not, you're not having really serious complaints, or that you're dealing with them in another way, or?
Madam Chair, Senator Messily, I'm not sure how to explain it. I mean, it's our complaints fluctuate, and it's sometimes really hard to explain what happens and why it happens. I don't see a trend with those, and so we don't really have an explanation for it. There will be some this year.
Madam Chair, I just like to make a quick statement here. I got to go make a phone call. I'll be back in 5 minutes. But it's my sense that the errors that occur on dispensing really occur primarily because of physicians' handwriting and physician errors, because they're in such a rush in their offices these days, and the errors they make in writing those prescriptions. And our backstop often is that pharmacist gives me a call or gives a physician call and says, did you mean, this? Because prescription, obviously, the dosage is not dosage even available in that drug. And that is something that pharmacists help us with. We have a great working relationship with those pharmacists. And when you look at the millions of prescriptions that are filled in the state every year and the number of errors that are made by pharmacists, it's minuscule. But it still needs to be looked at. And I'm most concerned about the relationship between pharmacists and physicians and how we clear up the handwriting problems and the error problems between that group. Because I think that's where most of these errors probably come from. And that's why I was asking those sort of leading questions about, for the most part, requiring that we have printed in some way form prescriptions going out. Because there are programs available off computers now. You hit a button, it prints the prescription, you have the patient, they take it in, which would eliminate a lot of errors. And that's the kind of thing I like to see coming forward more and more. There are times when you're in a position, you have to write a handwritten prescription, but it should become less and less of a occurrence, I believe, in our present technology. And I think that's where most of the errors occur. Do you think that's where the errors are occurring for the most part also?
Representative Bates, if I could respond, I don't know if that's most of them, but that certainly is a significant part. And we do require, and we have taken disciplinary action, usually in the form of a reprimand, when a pharmacist has inappropriately dispensed something or dispensed what they thought they saw, but it was wrong. I mean, we require them to communicate with the physician anytime there's a question. I mean, if there's a decimal point dropped or the dosage doesn't look right, I mean, this medicine, comes in 0.5 milligrams, not 5 milligrams. So if there's a question, don't assume one or the other. Call the prescriber and confirm that. And some pharmacists don't like doing that because the clinics are busy and they're going to interfere with somebody. I mean, it's that communication that I think does need some facilitation. We agree with what you're saying, absolutely.
I think it's something we need to work out.
Yeah, this is like musical chairs.
I apologize.
Don't take this personally.
Just apologize. We have not used you all.
It'd be real boring, huh?
Which can be lethal.
Yeah. Please proceed.
I think next up on our format is the organizational chart, which we have in Appendix C. That's page 30, or right behind page 30. It's a nice symmetrical organizational chart. This was current as of the legislatively approved 2013 budget. This includes the two positions that were authorized by the emergency board in November of 2001. Ms. McLean right here occupies one of those positions.
Beg your pardon.
Go ahead.
Okay, the two pink boxes are our new positions.
No. Madam Chair, Representative Smith, no. That's the colors are sort of to indicate different levels of management. The two new positions are
fuchsia.
I'm told this color is fuchsia. Administrative director on the left. That's a new position, and right below that one on the right, administrative secretary. That's
Oh, I see.
Those are the new positions. There's not a color code to identify those.
Okay, follow up.
And those were new in the 0103 biennium.
Madam Chair, that's correct, and authorized by the emergency board.
Did,
go ahead, please.
I'm sorry. Did the emergency board allow you to change your fee structure to pay for that, or are you asking for that here today? Or?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, the emergency board authorized the allocation, the expenditure limitation, including the fee increase for that.
And we
initiated that fee increase in the interim through the DAS 333 process.
Okay, and when did that fee increase take place to your local pharmacies?
Pharmacies were, I don't know if they've paid it yet, have they? The pharmacies are due March, end of March. Pharmacists are due the end of June.
Okay.
They renew, so they both have.
For this entire biennium, excuse me.
And then am I correct then in this other paper I saw wherever you're asking for another fee increase?
Madam Chair, Representative, no. What we're asking, and the bill we'll discuss, 5044, I believe, asked for ratification of what the e-board already did.
I just didn't want to make sure that it was a double deal.
Can you talk to us a little bit about the process that you go through internally when you decide that you need to change your fee structure? And what I'm real interested in is the how much buy-in you get from the people that are impacted by the changes.
Yeah, Madam Chair, we didn't just decide to do the fee increase. We were working on our budget, and it's when the money that's coming in doesn't support the activities that we're doing that we think we're required to do, then we have to look at where the revenue is going to come from, and that's where our revenue is with the fees. And so if the increase in the numbers of licensees doesn't keep up with the revenue that we need, then we consider fee increases. And that's what we did in the 0103 preparation for the 0103 budget. We knew we weren't going to have enough to cut it, and so we went to the State Pharmacy Association. We went to virtually every stakeholder that we had, the chain stores, the hospitals, the colleges, pharmacy, and consumers. And we had absolutely no opposition to the fee increase. It had been 11 years since a previous fee increase, and our stakeholders could see that, you know, because of the computer, you know, information technology problems we were having, we couldn't produce reports and deal with information. And because of our staffing level, we weren't able to, you know, to address their concerns with any sensitivity. So they wanted us to step up to the plate, and they knew that it would take that fee increase. They were willing to pay for it at the time. Tom Holt is the executive director of the State Pharmacy Association, was planning to be here this morning. He provided testimony at Ways and Means 0103 in support of the fee increase.
Thank you. Further questions, Representative
Snow?
Please go ahead.
To follow up with the organizational chart, you have a copy with this cover letter of a list which includes actually our internal operational teams. We have internally included these operational divisions as a way to kind of manage our workload. And this this chart shows you the dollar figures. I'm looking at the chart that's behind that first.
Okay.
But it's the same data shown differently. This chart just indicates administration, operations, testing and licensing, compliance, and recovery program.
You're referring to your priority list?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Priority list. And I just wanted to show you that in relation to the organizational chart to show you how we divide up the workload, how we divide up the workflow in these logical sequences. And this also is really the only way to assign FTEs in any meaningful way, because there's so many activities that involve each one of those, and there's a lot of overlap. But this is one way to demonstrate it, and the pie graph right behind that gives you another way to look at, you know, our overall resources. This is how it breaks down. And we've tried to list some of the, or examples at least, of the functions under each one of the divisions so you can see what they do.
Questions or comments?
And one last comment I'll make before Karen looks at the numbers. The Board of Pharmacy is in a unique position relative to the other regulatory agencies because this agency regulates not only the professional practice of the individuals, but according to the statute, we regulate the quality and the distribution of drugs throughout the state. So we have to deal with the stores, the pharmacies, the hospitals, the manufacturers, the wholesalers, which puts additional stress really on our compliance staff. At page 15, there's some written discussion about that.
I have a question.
Go ahead. I hope this is not out of order, but I, too, have to be excused in a few minutes. But I wanted to get my question in. And I'm reading off a document we haven't gone over, and I apologize.
The LFO summary?
Yeah. This is something that I'm acutely aware of. There's a large increase in the board's compliance and due primarily to pharmacists becoming more involved in direct patient care and drug therapy management. Now, I have seen a trend in the last couple of years at my local pharmacy, for instance, where pharmacists are now able to give flu shots, and they're able to do certain things that I thought only should have been reserved to a doctor, because I considered maybe pharmacists were acting in the capacity of a doctor. Can you address that?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, without knowing the specific examples you're referring to, I do know that we regulate our scope of practice, and if anyone is practicing outside of that scope, we will go take a look at them. I do know that pharmacies and pharmacists are increasing their scope and range of the things that they do, and maybe you're referring to some of the health screen testing, laboratory testing.
I'll use an example.
Cholesterol screening and
I'll use an example, and I was a perfect example of this. I couldn't get a flu shot at my local clinic, but I went down and got one at the pharmacy. Went to the pharmacist and says, can I have a flu shot? Yeah, sure, go ahead. Without even reviewing any of my medical history to know whether I should have a flu shot, you know, whether I would have an adverse reaction to it, or without any initial intervening consultation. And I had a complaint from my local doctor on this, so I'm wondering, what are pharmacists doing within their scope of practice? Because I know it's out there.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, for pharmacists to be able to even participate in that immunization program, they have to go through a training program and get a certificate. The Pharmacy Association is organizing most of those programs. So they get training and a certificate, and there are procedures, I believe, written by the Health Division, regarding immunizations and information that has to be transmitted and records that have to be kept. So if any of that wasn't done, then that would be worth an investigation.
And then who is the ultimate authority that can say, I guess, that it's okay for pharmacists to act within this scope of practice? Is it the medical board that does this? Is it the pharmacy board?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, the pharmacy board would do that by statute. Each one of the health professions develops their scope of practice by statute. And so if the Board of Pharmacy thought that pharmacists ought to be doing this or pharmacists are trained for that, if that wasn't already within our scope of practice, we'd have to come to the legislature and change that.
Okay. It's an interesting dichotomy here of what's within pharmacist scope of practice, I think.
Well, at some point, that must have been legislatively approved.
Evidently.
And it would be interesting to know if you voted for it.
It would be interesting.
If I might respond, Madam Chair. This was approved in the legislature in 9901, I believe. There was a bill specifically that...
I voted in favor of it because we're in the rural area that I live, that it is a hardship for people to get into a physician for something like that.
Mm-hmm. I'm done.
Please,
Madam Chair, members of the committee, then the last point I was making was that what drives the workload and affects our workload is that the dual role that we regulate the profession and the distribution of drugs and the corporations are getting bigger and bigger, and you know our investigations no longer involve the neighborhood pharmacist where we can talk to them and work out. I mean, there are still some independent pharmacies and communities where we can call the pharmacist and deal with issues and we're done. The larger corporations are not so simple. We call the pharmacist and we hear that the pharmacist is required to call the corporate counsel before they can respond, and then corporate counsel talks to government affairs, and a week or a month later we get a call from the vice president for government affairs saying what was the problem you guys have out there. So the investigations take longer and they're more complex, and we have to be a lot more careful with the evidence gathering and the documents that we use because we're dealing with corporate legal divisions. And
the members, in the interest of time, we have another board that we need to go through this morning, and I was hoping to be done with this presentation in 15 minutes. So,
Madam Chair, could I ask just one quick question? I'm interested in the scope of your complaints, whether you can see a pattern of the complaints coming from the larger chain pharmacies or whether it's from the neighborhood pharmacies.
Madam Chair, Representative Messerly, there's not really a pattern. There have been spikes in certain corporations. I mean, I guess in 1999 there was an issue with a corporation who purchased a corporation from out of state purchased a corporation in state that had 75 pharmacies. And that year there were lots of complaints and a number of violations because this corporation from out of state, they had a model that they operated their stores nationwide on, and the stores that they bought in Oregon didn't fit that model at all. These were big stores, the Payless stores. And so the model that this corporation was trying to use to run them didn't work. And, it took them almost a year to get where they needed to be. And in the meantime, there were lots of allegations and complaints. And so we had a big spike in the chain pharmacy that year. But in general, they come from everywhere, and there really isn't.
I think now we're going to turn it over to Ms. McClain.
Well, and Executive Director Schnabel asked me to speak about the actual budget numbers and our policy packages this morning, Madam Chair and Representatives. I am new to the board.
Could I ask you to move the microphone or move closer to the microphone?
How about
so that?
That we can Is that better?
Pick up your voice better.
Is that better? Okay. I'm new to the board. I've been there for about a year and have been working with this data for the last 6 or 7 months. I'm new to my position in November as the administrative director. Basically, we have three packages, policy packages, that we are requesting funds for. The first one, it is on page 24 of your presentation. It's policy package 231. Is really a request for permanent position reclassifications. We worked with DAS Human Resources, and they did an analysis, which is actually complete in the back of your budget binder. I provided that for you. To reclass the top three positions, the office manager, office specialist one, and office specialist two positions. And the fourth position is actually an administrative reclassification that DAS is currently working on to eliminate the principal contributor to category. And that was, they had advised us to move that position to a healthcare investigator. That's the part-time pharmacist recovery network position. So that package is simply about those four positions, and the total of it is $23,796. And at this time, we have reclassed with DAS approval and are requesting permanent funding to reclass appropriately the positions to match the positions with the levels that they.
So does this require an expenditure increase for you so that you can fund these positions?
That amount is $23,796. Okay. That's all four of the positions. That's the difference. Additional questions? Okay. Policy package 232. The IT software maintenance is $34,000, and what that really is, during the November 2001 e-board, which is regarding the fee increase that we talked about, and the $243,000 were allocated to replace our existing database that is crashing and burning every week. We could not produce a license for 4 days last week out of this database because it is so old and because of the problems associated with it. And again, for an entire week in the month of December, it is a critical problem. And we can't do our work without this database. And so we are in the process of working very closely with IRMD, and we are working with the Enterprise Committee regarding the licensing database that they would like to implement. Our project is a fire that is already burning, and they recognize that, and so they are working with us to move that forward as quickly as possible. We intend to use those funds that have been allocated to us in this biennium, and the $34,000 is an amount of money that it will cost because it wasn't in that $243,000 to actually pay the maintenance fees to have ongoing service with vendors. That's what that is. Policy package 233 is $62,473, and that includes two positions. One of those positions exists today. We have an interagency agreement with the Board of Nursing for a network support person. We do not have any IS people in our on our staff, and so Board of Nursing is just down the hall, and we've worked out with them an interagency agreement with the other health-related licensing boards on our floor to have a portion of that person's time allocated to the Board of Pharmacy. And we have asked for $13,903 to basically correct and bring it up to the level of the amount of time that we are using and account for what wasn't accounted for in 2001, 2003, the actual salaries and OPE. It's really to just say we're spending this much time and this is how much this person's time is according to figures that were provided to us by the Board of Nursing. The second part has to do with our new database. And the Board of Nursing is currently asking this legislation for a new position of a database administrator. And we have talked with them about an interagency agreement and getting a portion of that person's time to be our database administrator also. And so we are working with them on that. It, depending on whether or not they get that position, will depend on whether or not we enter into an interagency agreement. But regardless of whether they do or don't, we will require somebody to do database administration for us on our new database. And that's it in its simplest form in those three packages. Are there any questions about that?
No.
Okay, good. And really, the final thing is just on page 19. It gives a summary of our expenditures comparing 2001, 2003. I'm not sure what else to say about it except that it paints the picture about our ending balance. Oh, the one final thing I do want to say is that in the process of my being new and evaluating these numbers over and over again, even till 8 o'clock last night, I really believe that we have an inflated estimate revenue line for 2003-2005. And I'm going to be working very hard and have been working very hard with our BAM analysts to find that out. Yes?
What do you mean by that on your ending balance?
Well, if you look on page 19 on the very top on the right, it says incoming balance estimated revenue.
Uh-huh.
That estimated revenue, I'm fairly confident, is about $160,000 high, which would reduce our ending balance that much also.
So your ending balance would be around $1,000,001.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that kind of a high ending balance, or is it not? Sounds to me like it's high. I don't know.
I believe it's currently at about 10 months. It's at 10 months right now with these figures, so it would be 9 months.
Okay. Then, and you've asked for a bunch of stuff in your policy packages, and your new fee structure will take care of your policy packages? Okay.
Senator Gordon. Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like to take us to the report under Senate Bill 786, which is
page
detailed 37. Starting on page 37, Appendix I. And there is some very useful information here to guide our future policymaking, and I want to thank the Pharmacy Board for the very detailed analysis of the data that you sought. This is an excellent report. It also tells us where we have a lot of opportunities. Representative Bates was just pointing out to me, and I'm sure he'll speak to this, the data on page 40, which reveals what our pharmacist workforce looks like by race and ethnicity. And if you look under the racial breakdown, you can see that we have a long way to go in our recruitment efforts statewide. But I'd like to take us back to the previous page, 38, and just point out several things that you have pointed out to us. In that summary, you point out that one in four of Oregon's licensed pharmacists currently works in the profession outside of the state. And you make the point that this pool of active pharmacists may prove to be an important resource as we look to meet the expected demand for pharmacists in Oregon over the next decade. You make the point that the ethnic and racial diversity of the pharmacist workforce is limited. So you currently understand what the challenges are. You also make the point that our pharmacist workforce is aging, and you make some other comments about that. You also tell us that Oregon depends heavily on other states to train its pharmacist workforce, and that this is true for both urban and rural areas of the state. And as has been pointed out earlier by representative comments from our chair, that there are imbalances in the supply of pharmacists in rural versus urban areas. Again, major challenges for us as we look ahead at how we provide health-related resources to all of our Oregon citizens. Again, in pointing out these particular points in your summary of data collection, I just want to say that you've done what we hoped would happen under Senate Bill 786, and that is give us good data that we can then analyze that will then inform our public policy making. And thank you for that. And let's all now look at how do we do the recruitment of young people early and get them into the field. And I believe that there are some ways that we can do that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
Very quickly, because we're short of time, but this is an issue that is part of our society and one which we all have a responsibility for trying to correct. A couple of quick questions. Many of the tech positions, I believe, would probably find are filled by minority members. And those tech positions, if they're encouraged, might go on to pharmacy schools, and that could be a role the board could play for us, as well as helping them financially get to those schools. Also, pharmacists going out into minority schools and telling people, you can do this, would be I think, a powerful tool. The other issue I have is what's happened to, what is the size of, and how many graduates are we producing at Oregon State University at our pharmacy school? Has that changed over the years? Are we increasing that number?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, that's interesting because there is something that's happening right now at the College of Pharmacy that I wrote about in the binder but didn't say anything about in the summary. That is the education requirements for the pharmacist has changed, and the amount of time it takes to graduate from pharmacy has increased, and the entry-level degree requirement has changed. So as of 2004, the minimum entry-level requirement will be the Doctor of Pharmacy degree in order to sit for the license. Oregon State University only offers the Doctor of Pharmacy degree now. That was a switch 2 years ago. So in 2001, we only had 2002, we only had two graduates from the College of Pharmacy. We had 90 graduates in 2001, and that's about where they will be. The reason they only had two last year is because that's the first class that had to go through the six-year program. So they were there studying. They just didn't get to graduate. They had to do another year before they could graduate. The college anticipates 55 in 2003 and then up to somewhere between 70 and 90 every year then on. That's their capacity and the funding that they have. But that particularly 2002 was a problem because they couldn't graduate anybody. And that's happening in colleges all across the country. This is a national requirement through the American College of Pharmaceutical Education. They have required that the PharmD degree is the minimum.
Follow up?
Yes, Madam Chair. I would suggest that you look at those policies very carefully, because at a time when we have a shortage of pharmacists in the state, and the ones we have are overburdened and overworked, to slow the process down for graduating people is counterproductive. I mean, that's just a little insanity there. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what, you know, we have state funds rolling into that program to produce people who ultimately we think would be better trained, but if you're slowing the process of getting them out of the pipeline, I don't see the advantage there, and that's something that should be looked at. You need to fix that process and get those people through that program and get them graduated. I can't believe that you're going to cut the number of graduates from 90 to 2 in 1 year on the basis of we want them to have a six-year program instead of a five-year program. There's ways of easing that through without going through that sort of a draconian change. The other thing is, I'd like to know why you feel pharmacists are leaving the state. Are they better paid in other states than they are in this state? What's the reason that we have an exodus of pharmacists?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, the pay varies, and Oregon is somewhere in the mid-range. We don't see an exodus. It's always been that way, and all states have approximately that number of pharmacists that just move away and go to work somewhere else. They maintain their license in the state they came from because that's a requirement to reciprocate your license into another state. The National Association Boards of Pharmacy requires that. For example, if I'm originally licensed in Oregon by exam, I have to keep the Oregon license if I want to reciprocate to another state.
Senator Gordley, you're looking like you need to ask a question.
I just want to probe, if I may, in this area that Representative Bates is raising. Because, again, you do have a finding on page 39 that says many pharmacists plan to leave Oregon and work in the profession elsewhere within the next 2 years. And while it's uncertain how many of those planning to leave will actually do so, it may be important to conduct a follow-up investigation. So I guess, you know, probing a bit further, how many is many, and when will we know a more definitive answer to that issue?
Madam Chair, Representative Gordley, I'm not sure when we'll know an answer. It is a problem. One of the things that happens, though, is pharmacists, the questionnaire indicated that a lot of pharmacists say, yeah, I might leave to go do something. there are also pharmacists that want to come to Oregon. And so, you know, we really have about a net zero on pharmacists leaving and pharmacists coming in. I don't know the exact figure about that, but it's close.
Stay tuned.
I think what's happening for the shortage is, be careful how I say this, whether this is a shortage of pharmacists or whether it's too many drugs. I mean, and I say that a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but the demand for corporations opening pharmacies on every corner, and they have to have a pharmacist in there to run that operation, that's part of what's driving the shortage, is the demand for those people to staff the pharmacies that are there now. Pharmacies want to run 24 hours a day in some cases, so they have to have three shifts of pharmacists there. So we don't have fewer pharmacists. We're still producing the pharmacists. We're just not keeping up with the demand.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Hey, are we ready for Mr. Patton to take over and give us BAM's presentation?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jeremy Patton with the Department of Administrative Services. I'll try and go over my presentation rather quickly here so you guys can move on. If you go ahead and turn to page 2 in the presentation, this is a chart that shows a brief overview of the board's budget. As you can see, the budget is $3,006,091 other funds, which is a 5.7% increase over the 2001-03 legislatively approved budget. The board consists of 16 positions, 15.5 full-time equivalency. This is an increase from the 2001-03 close of session, which is due to the November emergency board increase in the positions. Page 3 shows that the board is at 100% other funds.
I love these.
Rather simple charts.
Useless.
For these smaller boards, the charts aren't quite as useful.
Just couldn't tell us, could you? Had it with a graphic there. They may not get this.
Page 4 shows a brief overview of the governor's budget. The budget continues the current level of services to its licensees and citizens, reclasses 4 positions, includes funds for computer software and increased computer network support, and increases fees for pharmacists and pharmacies. Page 5 shows that the board is just one program unit. Page 6 is a breakout of the budget categories. As you can see, 75% of the board is personal services. The other 25% is services and supplies. Page 7, the board did make an appearance at the November emergency board, which gave them limitation for their computer system upgrade and the establishment of 2 new full-time positions. There's also another adjustment in the third special session for their compensation plan. As far as the essential packages, package 010 includes a vacancy savings adjustment, which brings the total savings for vacancies to about $17,800. Also includes standard inflation of 3.5% for temporary appointments and a decrease in mass transit tax. Page A, package 020 is a program adjustment which reduces the expenditure limitation in 2003-05 for the computer system that was awarded in the November emergency board. Package 030 is the inflation. The board did use a standard inflation for services and supplies of 3.5%. This package is smaller for the board than you might see of other boards of size because the board did take a reduction of about $44,000 for rent because a Portland State Office Building reconciled the square footages on the fourth floor, and pharmacy had about 1,000 less square feet than they were charged for. As far as policy packages, package 090 is a program reduction made usually by the analysts. This reduces the Attorney General to reflect actual expenditure trends. Page 9, the first policy package is package 231, which includes the 4 position reclassifications. Package 232 is the software maintenance upgrade that the board mentioned earlier at $17,000 per year for a new software agreement. It's about $34,000 for the biennium. Package 233 is a computer network support, and this is the 2 IT positions that the board talked about. And package 234 includes the revenues for the increased fees for pharmacists and pharmacies. These revenues are about $573,750, all other funds. The only technical adjustment for the board is the elimination of the impact of the merit increases, which Budget Management and Legislative Fiscal Office are currently working on. Any questions?
Questions or comments? Senator Mazzoli.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Tell me if my math is wrong, but my figures came up with about a 36%. The ending balance is about 36%, over 36% of the budget. It seems high to me. It seems extremely high to me. Does DAS have a position on that or our fiscal office?
Madam Chair, Senator Messley, one of the reasons for the high ending balance is the fees were increased in 2001-03 mostly to pay for the large computer upgrade. So for next biennium, since that money is phased out, that money is no longer needed. But the ending balance, we feel, should remain there just so the board does not have to return for a fee increase in the immediate future. The board has gone 11 years without a fee increase until this time, so we feel with the current fees we can last longer into the future without coming back for a fee increase.
Further questions or comments? Thank you very much. We have two members of your board that are here. If you wish to come forward and testify, we'd be very happy to hear from you. But if you don't, that's fine too.
Give it a long one.
No, it's for you.
Pass it on to Steve Bender so he can put it in the section.
Chair.
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm Kathy Liu. I drove up from Eugene, and I did want to address Representative Bates' concerns about the prescriptions and moving toward electronic prescriptions. Our hospital and physician groups have moved in that direction, and while legibility is definitely an improvement, I think the concerns with electronic prescribing bring new issues, and I just wanted to say they are not the cure-all to the prescriber and pharmacist. We're having problems with incorrect drug selections on the drop-down box on the computers, incorrect patient selection on the computer, and so I think we're heading there, and I really think it gives physicians a great database and pharmacists an opportunity to legibly read the prescriptions, but it does create new prescribing errors that we have to be aware of. And in terms of the pharmacist and patient relationships, other states have moved toward some continuous quality improvement or quality assurance type programs, and I think that's something that's important for the board to look at to improve the errors prior to them, the meds getting to the patient, and identifying those errors without there being maybe the reprimands. Maybe there's a way to set up our system so that we can track those types of errors. So I do think that both of those, from that whole stream, starting from the physician to the pharmacist to the patient, we are very serious about looking at that.
If I might add to this, I'm Mike Patrick. I'm a board member from Redmond and drove over this morning. to add to what Kathy said as far as, you know, the drug errors being able to track them, I know the State Pharmacy Association, I believe, is trying to get a bill into this session to allow an interchange of this information. Right now, if we are notified about it, well, then we have to take action. And what we'd really like to be able is to track these errors and find out what's going on with them and helpfully prevent them. But right now, the sharing of this information is not feasible without reprimand to the practitioners, and I think they're trying to get some statutory protection and maybe kind of separate that out to where this process can take place and better improve, you know, reduce medication errors because we'll bring them out into the open. Also, we do report them to a national error tracking thing, tracking database. I know that Gary didn't mention too, maybe that, to try to find out, you know, what is a trend and to try to, you know, inform the pharmacists and the people out in the field to try to look for these things, too, to prevent errors. So I think we're working hard to try to prevent errors. One thing I would like to speak to, as far as our budget goes, this is my last term on the board. Ever since I've been on the board, we've been fighting to try to get our computer system up to grade where we can perform adequately. And I think with the help that we got out of the e-board session the last time to get on with our project, it's going to make an amazing difference in what we can do. It's like you've asked us to bring different data to you, and you know, regarding errors and regarding our information. And right now, our staff ends up spending hours trying to grind this out by hand because our system is so poorly put together that they can't do this. And I guess I really would like your support for that. Also, the fee increases, as a practicing pharmacist, to me are very reasonable compared to what other states are, what you know, what we get for this, for the increase. I don't see that as being a problem with the practitioner either.
Questions or comments for the board members? Thank you very much. I would just like to say, too, that I think that as a state, we don't thank people that volunteer to serve on the boards and commissions that we request people to serve on. And I just want to acknowledge the contribution that you're making and recognize that you're carving pieces out of your professional life and your personal life to serve on the pharmacy board, and that we really appreciate that. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 5026 and House Bill 5044 and open a public hearing on House Bill 5026, the Oregon State Veterinary Medical Examining Board. Would all of the veterinarians that wish to sit at the table please come forward?
Let's get Trader down here.
Let's begin with Ms. Jones from the Legislative Fiscal Office giving us the overview of her presentation.
Well, I attached in front of you, you should have a copy of my analysis for the Veterinary Medical Examining Board. The governor's budget is a 15% increase over the 2001-03 legislatively adopted level. The board's revenue is 100%. Other funds from the collection of fees, examinations, license, and other miscellaneous fees. There were no budget notes, no audit reports, and no interim reports or studies. There is a fee decrease for the veterinarians, which they're lowering the fees in order to lower an ending balance. Currently, they have 20 months of ending balance, and they're going to lower their fees so they can reduce that.
Thank you. Questions or comments for Ms. Jones? Thank you. The Dr. DeWeese.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. This is Dr. DeWeese.
Oh,
I'm
then you must
Mackinan.
Be Ms. Mannequin.
Mannequin, they called that.
I am famous for lacerating names, so please forgive me.
I am Laurie Mackinan, and I'm the director of the board. And Dr. DeWeese is supposed to be here, and I can't imagine what's keeping her because she hasn't missed a meeting in years. Maybe she was.
We will leave it in your capable hands.
Okay. I'll just briefly outline what the board is and what we do. We were created in 1903 originally as part of the professional organization, and issues of conflict of interest in the 50s resulted in the board being moved into the Department of Health. And then in 1975, through Senate Bill 390, the board became a separate agency. We operate under the authority of ORS 686, which we call the Practice Act, Veterinary Practice Act. Our mission is to ensure through enforcement of the Practice Act that the public receives qualified and quality veterinary services. We have 7 board members appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. 5 members are veterinarians, 2 are public members, and it appears, I just came from a hearing on our bill to add a technician position to the board, that we will indeed be adding a technician. We issue 4 types of licenses: veterinary, veterinary technician, euthanasia technician, and euthanasia facility. And here's Dr. DeWeese. The board ensures that applicants for each license meet state and national requirements and pass state and national qualifying exams. And this is Dr. Marty DeWeese.
Good morning.
Welcome.
Dr. DeWeese has been licensed in Oregon since 1983, and she owns and operates McKenzie Animal Hospital in Springfield. She was appointed to the board in 1997 and is currently serving her second term, which will expire in September of 2004.
Please take a moment to take your coat off make yourself comfortable.
I'll just, if you please, I'll just move along. We receive and investigate about 10 complaints per month. Most of the complaints that we get are not jurisdictional. In other words, they involve issues that we don't have authority to regulate, like communication, bad attitude, fees. But we feel that it's important to listen to complainants because generally they're in various states of grief or anger or over something that has happened to a beloved pet. In around 1997, we began logging complaints into an old, what is now a pretty primitive software system called DBase. Recently, we've upgraded to a Visual Fox Pro, and that has enabled us to to collect complaint data. I have, if anybody's interested, I can show you what the raw data looks like as it comes out. We're working on setting the program up to manipulate this data, use Kivo tables to generate real specific information about complaints. But generally what we have done up to now is just go in manually and count and come up with that. So
that's going to be a great step forward.
Excuse me?
This is going to be a good step forward to be able to automate this.
Oh, it'll be instant. It'll be instant. My investigator is going to be very happy. As Cindy said, we're going to waive some fees this biennium to reduce our cash balance to about 12 months. And I know that you want to hurry along, but I just wanted to share. This is our anniversary. We're 100 years old this year. And I just wanted to read something that I pulled out of our archive. This is from J.F. Morrell. It says, "Dear Sir, through the kindness of your Secretary of State, we obtained your name and right to ask if you will kindly furnish us with the latest list of practicing veterinarians in your state. We will highly appreciate the favor and gladly repay you for your trouble. Thank you in advance." This is from U.S. Veterinary Supply Company, dated April 20th, 1912. And this, in perfect you can't see it, it's perfect Palmer penmanship, dated May 27th, "Dear Doctor, does Dr. Stratton have a license to practice? Please find enclosed his ad in the Philomath paper." It's 1916. And this is, I saved my favorite one. This is from, I can't make out the signature. "Dear Doctor, Hopkins is back. I am paying taxes and I'm a citizen of the U.S., so if there is a way to nip him in the bud, I propose to find it out." This is about an unlicensed practitioner. And the state veterinarian responds, "Dear doctor, blah, 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 if Dr. Hopkins continues to practice, kindly advise, and I will take the matter up with the district attorney of Linn County." So,
it's a date on
1921. This, we are dealing with these same issues and have been for 100 years. So
some things never change.
Never change. So that concludes my presentation. We humbly request approval of our 0305 budget.
Questions or comments for Ms. Nackney? Dr. DeWeese, do you wish to make any comments at this point?
The only comment is that I've actually been in Oregon since 1972 when I got my license, and not 1983. But I'm sorry I'm late. I just couldn't get here in time.
Thank you. Let's move right along and let Adam take it away for BAM.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Adam Torgerson with the Department of Administrative Services. I'll go through our highly useful slide presentation that Jeremy just went through as well. So if you move right on to page 2, it shows that the board is requesting $492,831 of other fund expenditure limitation, which is about an 11.5% increase over the budget through the fifth special session.
Yes.
Can we go back to page 3 just for a minute?
Yes, there's an arrow. I was going to get to the arrow on page 3. It's certainly, it's just a typo. Definitely not lottery funds.
We wondered where you found this diagram here. Not only is this useless.
It has the typo, yes. On page 4, the governor's budget, just basic overview. The board's going to lower fees They have a $4,000 package to increase attorney general expenses. They actually could potentially use more than that. They're going to have a specific case. It's really been elevated a couple of times, and the board can speak to you more to that if you'd like to hear it. They also would like to add a veterinary technician to the board to increase the diversity of the board and decision-making. Their services and supplies split is about 56% to 44%. I'm all the way up to page 7. They had only the compensation plan adjustment in the third special session. Their inflation package, most of the inflation is in attorney general rent and state government service charges. The rent issue is not because of resizing. They were relatively correct in their size. It's just that the rent has gone up because the subsidy that was given in 1989 by the legislature is used up, so the rent overall is going to increase as a result of that. On page 8, the policy packages, there's a reduction in the analyst reduction package about the fees. Shows the two policy packages right there. And on page 9 is the amount of decrease of each of the fees that the board plans. And if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. No technical adjustments.
Very smooth dodging of the useless graph. The questions?
Madam Chairman, this isn't to Ben, but I realize that you folks are developing your report on the complaints and that type of thing. But I would be interested if verbally you can tell us, have you revoked licenses in the last few years, or how active are you in that regard?
Madam Chair, Senator Messerly, we have revoked in the last 10 years one license. We have three licensees on stipulated agreements, which means that they agree to do or not to do certain things in order to retain their licenses. We have fined about 10 licensees this biennium we had three unlicensed practice issues, two cases where the veterinarian failed to get client authorization, written authorization to perform alternative medicine.
Follow-up, Madam Chair. Do you have a problem with any officers or veterinarians using animal drugs for humans?
Thank you for reminding, Madam Chair, Senator. Thank you for reminding me. Those were the other two cases. We did have a situation where a veterinarian was using her veterinary license to order and dispense human drugs to her staff, and she was fined and publicly disciplined. And I think we had another one of self-prescribing. But overall, we don't have a large problem that we're aware of in that population with drugs.
But let me ask that in a little bit different way then. Have you had any problem with using animal-type antibiotics and things that they give to their staff or family members?
Madam Chair, Senator, not that I'm aware of.
Could you talk to the committee about the Attorney General issue that you have?
Yes, Madam Chair, members. We have a licensee who has been under one form or another of scrutiny since 1995, and this licensee she's the licensee whose license we revoked. Started with suspension, warnings, and so forth, and she has appealed each action that we've taken and has actually appealed to the Oregon Supreme Court, and we just got word last week from the appeals court that they have AWOP, they've affirmed without an opinion, so they've supported our action, but I fully expect her to appeal that to the Oregon Supreme Court again, and that's cost us a lot of money, and she just won't go. She's moved out of state, but she continues to appeal and file, and I get reports on her from various people throughout the state, you know, sightings of what she's doing, and she is coming back into the state a few times a year to practice. So,
So you have now a decision from the appeals court that affirms the lower court?
That's
and
right.
She has signaled her intention to appeal that to the Supreme Court.
She hasn't signaled it, but her history, unless she does a complete 180, she will appeal it.
Then you have to wait to see if the Supreme Court is going to accept the case or not and where to go from there.
Yes, Madam Chair, we do.
Madam Chair?
Senator Messer.
I find this interesting. Is this the appeals based on the revocation of the license, or is, it would seem to me if they continue to practice, there's a criminal act here at some point?
Madam Chair, Senator, the appeals, or her appeals, were based on the authority of the board to do what it did in one case, and in another, I don't remember what the appeal was based on. She has an attorney who likes to file paper, and so the arguments, in fact, in the last appeal, he didn't show up to argue, so they're basically just exercises, and I think that part of what the motivation is to stave off the ultimate action, which will be delivery of an administrative bill to her, probably of about $50,000. As far as our authority, we are currently, the professional organization currently is asking for expansion of our authority for civil penalties to unlicensed people of $5,000 per violation. This bill would also allow us to refer cases to the Attorney General rather than just to the district attorney, and the benefit there would be often district attorneys, for whatever reason, choose not to enforce veterinary laws because it's not high on their list of priorities. If we are able to take it to the DA, there's a greater likelihood that if it's a serious issue, the DA will pursue it, and it will also be a more objective situation because DAs are often tied to their communities in ways and don't want to pursue things that might be disruptive in the community.
Thank you.
Further comments or questions from the committee? Well, this one, I think, is our record time.
Madam Chair, I thought maybe BAM could address the issue of the board would like to come back during Ways and Means and request an expenditure limitation on an emergency basis.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I wasn't sure what order we were going to go there, but the board this biennium is projected to be a little bit overspent as far as its limitation. Most of it is regarding the Attorney General line item, and it's mostly regarding this case. They have also a situation where they have unemployment that they believe they're going to be paying out for the duration of the that it's available, that will also put them over a little bit more as far as budget versus actuals, what they actually need. BAM is doing the analysis to what the actual amount's going to be, but we're projecting somewhere between $10,000 and $20,000 of an additional request.
So this isn't going to have a significant impact on the ending balance situation?
No. Madam Chair, members of the committee, no. The board has a fairly high ending balance, and it won't significantly impact it.
So what I would assume then is at the point that you get the analysis done, that the limitation request will be introduced into the process.
I believe so. I'm not sure how the technical process is going to work. I'm going to work that out with Ms. Jones.
Anyone have questions about that or comments? Thank you.
Thank you.
Any further issues to be brought forward on the Oregon State Veterinary Medical Examining Board?
Senator Gordley. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question. Did this board not prepare a report under Senate Bill 786?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I do have a verbal report for you. That is. In compliance with the bill, we began a data collection process in our 01 renewal forms and on all application forms to collect the requested data, ethnic and bilingual information. And this process will probably over the course of one renewal period target all of our current licensees, and then as well as getting all of our applicants. We had a somewhat disappointing response. Since the response was voluntary, I don't think we had more than 25% of veterinarians providing the information. Slightly more veterinary technicians provided it. We do have a board member who is Hispanic and trilingual, And in the course of his routine outreach as the state's public health veterinarian, he visits middle and high schools and discusses veterinary public health issues and values and requirements for entry into the veterinary field.
Thank you. Madam Chair, it would be useful, helpful, if we could get that verbal report in a written form to members of the committee. That would be my request.
I'd also like to address the issue of the performance measures that you have. You've got performance measures that, but really no data behind them. Can you talk to us about what's going on here?
Yes, Madam Chair, let me just find my... The data that we would be using is also part of the database, and that for example, if we are measuring the time it takes to process an application, okay, let's start with average number of days to respond to licensee requests. I have not developed a way to measure that, so I don't know that that's really a good measure.
So what you're saying is that you don't have a way to measure your performance in your performance measures?
I think that's what I'm saying, yeah. Oh, if I... On page 2, where it says data sources, we do have daily input, a phone log, and investigation files. Most of our licensee requests, as I said, are about complaint issues. Except at renewal times, veterinarians call to find out if their renewals have been processed. We would measure the time it takes to issue a new license from the database because that information is recorded and, again, can be extracted fairly easily. We're proposing to do a customer satisfaction survey to see how many licensees rate us as good or better. Again, the database will provide complaint information. Right now on complaints, we're averaging about 110 days to close a complaint, and that might sound like a lot of time, but the board only meets every 2 months. So
you do have some pieces of data that you could put in here?
Yes.
Could we ask then that you do that and bring the information into LFO so that when we go into work session discussions on your budget, we'll have the data that you have? And if also you could put some kind of information together that would give us some idea of when you're going to come into compliance on providing the rest of the information. Comments, questions, further issues? Nothing? All right. All Representative Bates.
I discovered my lab one day trying to access your website about doggy bones. Do you get a lot of questions from labs about that nature?
About what?
I'm kidding you.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, I get a lot of weird questions. That hasn't been one of them.
They're a good source of calcium.
Chair finds Representative Bates a dozen donuts.
They'll be here tomorrow.
Madam Chair, I don't think we're working Dr. Bates hard enough.
Or maybe I'm being overworked, okay?
Madam Chair, I do have one.
Please go ahead, Senator Gordley.
Thank you. I'm thinking about a young woman who's going to be moving to the state of Oregon sometime this spring, and she's very interested in becoming a veterinarian. There's no one in her life experience who's done this, but you know, she's feeling like this is something she wants to do. She wants to explore. Do you as a part of what you offer through the examining board, have a directory that's, or any information that's focused on educational opportunities in the state for someone who has that interest?
Representative Morgan, Senator Gordley, we don't currently do that.
Okay.
If somebody were to...
Senator Gordley, if I could perhaps make a suggestion, the vet school at Oregon State University is very active.
I'm aware of that, and that's a contact that we will definitely be making. But I was just wondering if there was another link outside of that at your level, the board level, that...
Representative Morgan and members, Dr. DeWeese reminds me that OVMA, which is the professional organization for veterinarians, does have some outreach programs.
And that is the
Oregon Veterinary Medical Association, OVMA.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Having then no further...
I'm sure I just said
it's very brief. Too good to be true.
Well, I mean, we've got 20 minutes left. Well, we can't quit early.
God forbid a meeting goes on longer.
But I'm curious, do you have many doctors who go back to school and become physicians or physicians who move the other way and come into the veterinary practice?
Madam Chair, Senator Messerly, no. I don't believe we have any licensees who currently are MDs and DVMs, but we seem to have a few who are JDs and DVMs. That seems to be more of a co-interest for them.
Yes, thank you.
Okay,
I'm done, Madam Chair.
This is final call here. I'm going to end the hearing on House Bill 5026, and thank you very much for the time you've given us today. Thursday we have scheduled the dietitians and the nursing home administrators, and the binders were available. If you haven't taken them, they're still available. We will begin. Is there anything we need to know additional to that we have those two things on our plate for tomorrow?
No, that would be it. Sorry.
Then I will adjourn the meeting, and we will reconvene at 8:30 tomorrow morning.
Okay.